morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Monday, January 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is Inauguration Day for Donald J. Trump. We will take a look at his unconventional path to the presidency.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
The Trump inauguration has been moved indoors due to frigid temperatures. We'll take you behind the scenes during moving day at the White House. Hamas frees three hostages during a ceasefire with Israel. Kenya deploys more police officers in Haiti to curb gang violence. DRC and Rwandan-backed army are accused of using explosives in densely populated areas.
The international community must publicly condemn the use of explosive weapons in populated areas, urge the warring parties to stop attacking civilians, and demand accountability.
And wife of jailed Ugandan opposition leader Besigye says prison authorities are denying her husband his choice of family-supplied food. Those stories, plus Samson Omali's reports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Donald Trump takes the oath of office today, January 20th, to become the 47th president of the United States. It is a historic return to power for a man who, in just over 9 years, reshaped the Republican Party in an increasingly divided country. VOA's Tina Tran looks at Trump's political comeback.
Donald Trump says he was reelected with a, quote, unprecedented and powerful mandate from American voters.
I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president. And every citizen, I will fight for you, for your family and your future. Every single day, I will be fighting for you, and with every breath in my body, I will not rest until we have delivered the strong, safe, and prosperous America that our children deserve and that you deserve.
Trump's return to power is part of his unwillingness to take no for an answer.
I think what you see is somebody who has incredible confidence in his own intuition.
Russ Buettner and Suzanne Craig are New York Times investigative reporters and co-authors of Lucky Loser, an unflattering look at how Trump fashioned himself into a self-made billionaire.
He has not, since the early 80s, really trusted people who have subject area expertise in almost anything. He will always overrule them to make things the way he wants them to turn out.
Trump's buildings were emblazoned with his name in large gold letters, a brash display of his ambition and self-promotion.
He was worth $200 million when he would talk. It was the interview he gave to the New York Times, and that grew to $1 billion when he was talking to 60 Minutes a decade later.
Trump excelled at drawing attention and cultivating a brand for himself as a dealmaker. He made millions licensing his name. But behind the success were troubles. His companies filed for bankruptcy 6 times. His casinos lost money and were shuttered. Trump rebounded with his TV show, The Apprentice, which led to his biggest role yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Unapologetic and unfiltered, Trump was a polarizing nationalist candidate.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
As president, Trump appointed 3 Supreme Court justices who helped overturn federal abortion rights.
The U.S. death toll now above 150,000.
In early 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic tested Trump. He fast-tracked the development of life-saving vaccines, but he also appeared to suggest that scientists study injecting bleach to kill the virus. With over 9 million Americans infected and a death toll exceeding 230,000, voters that November chose Joe Biden as their next president. Out of office, Trump faced multiple criminal indictments and is the first former president to be a convicted felon. And yet, he's never been more popular. Surviving two assassination attempts this year has only strengthened the bond between him and his supporters.
God has a plan for Trump, and he absolutely was spared for some purpose and reason, and hopefully it's to become the 47th president.
American politics has never been the same since Donald Trump entered the field, and the man who once co-authored The Art of the Comeback is returning to power after engineering one of the biggest in American history. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
For the first time in 40 years, the U.S. inauguration today, Monday, will be held indoors. Washington views every presidential inauguration as different than the last one, but this one will really stand out. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Presutti explains.
Known as the President's Own, the Marine Band has performed at every inauguration since 1801. But this time, musicians will not have to worry about their instruments freezing up because the inauguration will be held inside the U.S. Capitol due to freezing temperatures. On Monday, listen for these musicians to create the soundtrack as Carrie Underwood sings America the Beautiful, then to play Hail to the Chief immediately after Donald Trump is sworn in as president. Master Gunnery Sergeant Leslie Barrett has played oboe since the 2001 inauguration.
It may be my seventh time, but every time is special. It's all a little bit surreal that I get to be a part of this piece of history and that we get to observe and participate in this major event, not just in the U.S., but in the world. So it may be the same, but it will never be the same.
But I will faithfully execute.
And this one will definitely stand out. The last time frigid temperatures caused the swearing-in to be moved indoors was 1985. That was for President Ronald Reagan's second term. Outdoor preparations for the 250,000 ticket holders began more than a month ago. That included construction of the platform at the U.S. Capitol, the building of parade stands, and 48 kilometers of sidewalk barriers, more than any previous inauguration. Thousands may still come to the Washington Mall to watch the event. That includes first-timers Xander Goss and Olivia Connolly.
I've never been to one before. I'm pretty new to the city, so it feels like good timing.
My mother was 9 months pregnant with me at George W. Bush's inauguration 4 days before giving birth to me. So maybe it's my second inauguration, technically.
Monday is all about democracy, despite a polarizing election. Anita McBride worked at the White House for four administrations.
That day is an example to Americans and to the world that our country transitions and we have a new government.
Following the swearing in, the president typically rides in a parade and then exits the limousine to walk the final block to the White House. Instead, for this inauguration, newly sworn-in President Donald Trump will appear less than 3 kilometers away from the Capitol at this indoor arena before some 20,000 people. History will show a different look for the second inauguration of this president. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
When Donald Trump is sworn in as the nation's 47th president today, there will be a swirl of activity behind the scenes at the White House. Over about 6 hours, the personal belongings of outgoing President Joe Biden and his family will be removed from the executive mansion, while the private residence will be made into a home for the newly sworn-in president. VOA's Dora McQuarrie reports.
The moment Joe Biden leaves the Oval Office for the last time, likely in the morning on Inauguration Day, the White House staff jumps into action, rearranging the iconic office to the tastes of the incoming president. Angela Reid was chief usher at the White House from October 2011 until May 2017.
They like the Oval Office to be outfitted, what rug, what, you know, what drapes, what desk, etc. Because that's the kind of the Oval Office is the first area to be sort of prepared.
Photos show that Biden changed the rug and some chairs in 2017 after taking over from Donald Trump, who preceded him and will also succeed him.
Thank you, Donald. Congratulations.
But it looks like the couches and curtains remain the same. The president's family lives on the second and third floors of the White House. Before moving day, the incoming president and first lady choose what furniture and art they want from the White House collection. By the time the new president arrives home on Inauguration Day, the furniture is in place and personal family photos are on the walls. Kate Anderson Brower has written three books about the White House, including The Residence.
When the new president and first lady move in, they have their favorite shampoo in the shower. They have their toothbrush, toothpaste on the counter. They have their clothes hung up in the closet.
It all happens in under 6 hours, with about 100 White House staffers pitching in, according to Brower.
You don't have professional movers doing this. You have the resident staff doing it. So you have everybody pitching in, and these are not people that are trained as movers. They don't hire professional movers because of security concerns.
Many of the White House resident staff worked for Donald Trump during his first term, from January 2017 until January 2021. Here's Brower again.
So the staff really did like Donald Trump because he's used to having people around him serving him. And, you know, he would go around tipping staff in cash, you know, handing out 20s and 50s. And they appreciate that. They are not political. They just care about how the president treats them.
President Barack Obama hired Angela Reid to be the White House's chief usher in 2011. She oversaw moving day in January 2017 when the Obamas moved out and the Trumps moved in.
We have used the term organized chaos, but it really is a very coordinated operation. It's been rehearsed, so many times that on that day, everyone is just chomping at the bits for go time.
There were some hiccups, like having to use only one elevator, according to Reid.
The elevator was not, you know, being used to its most optimum. So I took responsibility for an hour of the time, sort of riding that by actually running the elevator. There was an instance of maybe one mattress for one specific room not being the right size.
But the main challenge is always the time constraint and having just about 6 hours to get everything ready to welcome the new presidential family home to the White House for the first time. Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
Hamas released three hostages on Sunday as part of a newly reached ceasefire deal with Israel. U.S. President Joe Biden, on his last full day in office, spoke from Charleston, South Carolina, about the development. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
Freedom for the first three of 33 hostages to be released by Hamas in phase one of the deal. The Israeli military confirmed the handover as part of a recent ceasefire agreement. The International Committee of the Red Cross received the freed hostages, all of them women.
And after so much pain, destruction, loss of life, today the guns in Gaza have gone silent. I've worked in foreign policy for decades, and this is one of the toughest negotiations I've been part of.
The family of newly freed hostage Romy Gonin reacting to news of her release at a watch party in Israel. In exchange, Israel was freeing 90 Palestinian prisoners, 69 women, and 21 teenage boys. As part of the deal, in the next 6 weeks, Hamas will release 30 more hostages in exchange for about 2,000 Palestinians held by Israel. The truce clears the way for the flow of aid back into Gaza. And as for risks of the ceasefire collapsing, the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump says Hamas is backed in a corner.
They have no option except to let our hostages go. They cannot be a terrorist organization any longer, and they will never govern Gaza.
The deal itself was delayed by some 3 hours, during which Israeli warplanes launched attacks into Gaza. Palestinian medics say at least 13 people died. Israel says it was targeting terrorists. The hostage release and prisoner swap ceasefire deal comes after 15 months of fighting that reduced entire areas of the Gaza Strip to rubble. For displaced Palestinians returning home, it may be all they find as the drones and warplanes go silent. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Thank you. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, January 20th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Amnesty International has released a report accusing the Democratic Republic of Congo Army and the M23 militia group of using explosives in densely populated areas of Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Columbus Mavunga has details from Harare, Zimbabwe.
In an interview with VOA, Jean Mobet Senga, a DRC-based researcher with Amnesty International, said his organization had over a six-month period observed that the DRC Congo and M23 militia group, which is said to be backed by Rwandan troops, had used explosives in densely populated areas. This as their fight rages on in eastern DR Congo. Amnesty International says this has resulted in more than 100 deaths and thousands injured.
When used in populated areas, explosive weapons with wide area effects are very likely to have indiscriminate effects and cannot be narrowly directed at a specific military target as required by international humanitarian law. We call on both parties to immediately cease attacks on civilians and stop using explosive weapons with wide area effects in populated areas. The international community must publicly condemn the use of explosive weapons in populated areas, urge the warring parties to stop attacking civilians, and demand accountability. The ICC should consider investigating these attacks as war crimes with a view to bringing to justice those suspected of responsibility.
Senga said explosives were used in densely populated areas in 150 attacks last year. The International Criminal Court, Southern African Development Community, and the DR Congo Army and its government could not be reached for comment on the issue. Willy Ngoma, the spokesman for M23, comments on the accusations by the Amnesty International.
We can never use the explosives to kill the population. Never, 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 never. Hold a hand. The government is bombarding with the heavy artillery to kill the population. We are an army of the people to protect the population. We can never use the explosive to kill people. It is false and completely misleading.
The M23 or the movement of March 23 said to be backed by Rwandan troops has since 2021 occupied the mineral rich east of the DRC. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says about a quarter of a million people have been displaced since the beginning of 2025. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Columbus Mavunga in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Over 200 Kenyan police officers have been deployed to Haiti over the weekend. This is the third batch of police from Kenya under the United Nations Multinational Security Support Mission in Haiti. Kenya's Interior Ministry said the additional officers will help fight violent gangs that have taken over the troubled Caribbean nation. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
The latest deployment of 217 Kenyan police officers follows an earlier deployment of 400 officers sent by Kenya in June. Kenya pledged to lead the UN-backed Multinational Security Support Mission, MSS, to restore peace in Haiti. Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary Kipchumba Murkomen said the Kenyan-led mission in the troubled nation has made immense progress in curbing gang violence. Speaking while receiving troops, Haitian President Alphonse Jean expressed his appreciation for the Kenyan troops who are restoring peace.
We have to say right now the Kenyan troops are in a region in Haiti called Atibonit, and they are fighting hard. These are challenging times for Haiti, and in challenging time, we need friends like you to help us face the challenges.
The Kenyan officers are expected to reinforce the mission's efforts to stabilize the country and support local security forces in their efforts to restore order. Kenya's Deputy National Security Advisor Joseph Boynet said UN member states have been in the forefront of the multinational security support mission.
I want to once again reiterate on behalf of the government and the people of Kenya that we will be with the people of Haiti all the way. And I want to reiterate what has been said about our determination to support the Haitian people towards restoring what they yearn for, and that is living a peaceful life.
At the same time, Kenya's Deputy Inspector General of Police, Gilbert Masengele, says the presence of the troops in Haiti has restored crucial operations in the country.
The police officers have executed successful operations against gangs in the support of Haitian police. The mission has operated in challenging and risky environments to protect civilians and the citizens in general. These efforts have achieved reopening of some critical access roads, connecting Port-au-Prince to other regions, restoring operations in learning institutions and the health facilities.
Kenya's President William Ruto has pledged to deploy 1,000 troops as part of the UN-backed force in Haiti. Gang violence has left more than 700,000 Haitians homeless in recent years. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The wife of jailed Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye says her husband does not want to go on a hunger strike just to make a point. However, Winnie Byanyima, who is also executive director of the United Nations AIDS agency, UNAIDS, says her husband has been given impossible choices. Dr. Besigye and a co-defendant are on trial in a military court for the unlawful possession of ammunition and a firearm. Byanyima tells me the prison authorities are denying Dr. Besigye his choice of family-prepared food, contrary to prison practices.
Dr. Besigye doesn't want to go on a hunger strike to make any point, but Dr. Besigye is being given impossible choices for his life in the prison. Since he was put in prison, the prison officials keep changing the rules around his welfare. Regarding his food, they've recently said that contrary to the practice that there for all other prisoners, where a prisoner's family can bring in food and he can have it cooked by himself in the prison, which is the method he has been using, that now they've been trying to force him to buy food from the prison authority itself. It has its own shop. He rejects that. He does not trust them. The people who abducted him from Kenya are the very ones running that prison. He doesn't trust his life with them. He wants to cook food brought by his own family, not food that he has to buy from prison authorities. So he's not going on hunger strike to make any point. He's saying, I'd rather starve than be poisoned by my very abductor.
But Winnie, I think what the prison authorities are saying is that every prisoner is supposed to eat the food provided by the prison system. So why should Dr. Besigye be treated differently?
That is not true at all. I go to the prison, see him. I arrive there, I find there other family members carrying lots of food, bringing it to their prisoners who cook for themselves. As a matter of fact, there is a facility inside the prison where they are allowed to make their own food. That prison is really a hell on earth because it was built to serve a few hundred people, but now is occupied by thousands. It's beyond 10 times the capacity that it was built for. So many, the food, the hygiene, the water, everything there is subhuman standards. So they allow prisoners to make their own food. He's not asking for anything special for himself. He's being denied what other prisoners have, which is the right to make their own food and to receive the ingredients from their families to cook for themselves.
Winnie Byanyima is the wife of Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye. She spoke with us from Munich, Germany. And that's it for this Monday, January 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton.